The world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
They got one.
Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join host Gene Pell and an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II,
a state of war,
to the present day.
Allied air forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
Now the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network present Veterans Chronicles with your host, Gene Pell.
Welcome to this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles. We're visiting today with retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Charles Crone, a Vietnam combat veteran, and the subject is his book, The Lost Battalion of Tet, Breakout of the 212th Cavalry at Hue. The book was originally published in 1993, but a revised and updated edition has been issued in 2008 to commemorate the 40th anniversary of the Tet Offensive. First, let's learn something about the author.
Well, I was born in Saginaw, Michigan in 1937 and grew up during the Second World War. And got very interested in that as a young child, even though I didn't know what was going on. My real frame of reference, though, was World War I, because during that time, all of the books and magazines were episodes from World War I. So, because nothing was being written about World War II, and in any event, that's kind of the first indication I had that I was interested in military affairs, but I didn't recognize that until about 30 years later. I went to the University of Michigan not knowing what I was going to do, a little stint at Stanford Law School. That wasn't for me, so I had an ROTC obligation, went to Korea for basically 2 years, got out, became a reporter for UPI and Flint Journal in Flint, Michigan, and when the Vietnam War was going full blast, I decided that if I was ever going to be a military writer, this was my war. UPI wouldn't send me to Vietnam. I was on the list, but at the bottom of it. So when the Army asked me if I'd like to return to active duty and be the public affairs officer of the 1st Air Cavalry Division, I jumped at the chance. I spent 8 months as the public affairs officer, and then I was invited to join an infantry battalion as the intelligence officer, which, of course, is the, you know, where the book is generated. And decided then when I came back that I really liked soldiering and I admired the people I was soldiering with very, very much, and decided to make a career of it. So I ended up doing 20 years, getting out, retiring in 1984. Nothing particularly important, except I was rather close to General Vaught and became the public affairs officer of the post-Desert One episode. And then I became a consultant and a military writer and a lot of miscellaneous things. I was the most famous thing I wrote was basically a discussion of the late Colonel David Hackworth, where I dug into his past and found out all kinds of things that Colonel Hackworth wasn't revealing about himself, such as doctoring his own records to give him much more than he was entitled to, and he finally acknowledged that, but died shortly afterwards. I then was invited to become the Deputy Chief of Public Affairs of the Army by Army Secretary Tom White in 2000. Enjoyed that immensely. Tom and I were old friends, and when White was fired by Rumsfeld, I still felt I had a little juice in me. So I went to Baghdad to help with the infrastructure reconstruction program as a public affairs advisor. That program never got off the ground while I was there, so I came back, accepted a position at the University of Michigan as the visiting professor of journalism. And after that, I was invited to join the staff of the American Battle Monuments Commission here in Arlington, Virginia. And we supervise the 24 overseas military cemeteries, mostly in Europe from World War I and World War II, and that's what I'm doing now.
Well, the book called The Lost Battalion of Tet, Breakout of the 212th Cavalry at Hue, is a remake of the book you did earlier, so several years ago. First question, you say in here that there were a lot of people who didn't want you to write this book. I'm curious about that.
Well, I can elaborate that for a long time, but the short version is I talk about the nervous breakdown of the division commanding general during the period that we were surrounded. It was General John J. Tolson III. He later got promoted to 3 stars in command of the 18th Airborne Corps at Fort Bragg. Everybody who witnessed his nervous breakdown was sworn to secrecy, and he had quite a following because he was a very decent person. And he had quite a following who thought that this book would be embarrassing to his memory, and therefore they were concerned that I was vilifying a man who was respected by many. And there are lots of variants of that, but that's the essential story.
In the time between you first wrote the book and the time you revised it, what did you come to learn that you hadn't known before?
Well, first, my first impulse to issue a new book or a revised version was to record in the new foreword the reaction of those who read the book, learning for the first time how their brother or father died, and expressing their sentiments to me. In one case, I got a call from the deputy chief of police at Virginia Beach, who used my book to find the hasty grave where we buried the 11 soldiers that we had to leave behind when we walked out of encirclement. And there's some pictures of that site that he took in this book. And he explained to me the effect that his brother's death had in the family. He said fundamentally it destroyed the family. I mean, they stopped celebrating Christmas and holidays. And that when they he went back and found his brother's grave, found an old Vietnamese farmer who was able to point out the depression in the ground where that grave was, that it brought closure to the family. And I thought that was a remarkable story. Another story was a soldier called me crying, and without going into all those details, he said that he had been shot in the head 11 times by a North Vietnamese machine gun and had total amnesia after that period, and reading my book brought back his memory. And then he put his wife on, who verified it. But another story had to do with a family in Wisconsin who told me that when they read the first version of the book, explained how their son had, her brother, had died, and they had never been told by the Army the details that were contained in this book. And a day or two after they were able to read the story to the soldier's mother, she died, and it was a great closure for the family, and they much appreciated it. Mm-hmm. The other thing, I learned more. I didn't rewrite the guts of the book because that was the framework of the book. And so it wasn't meant to be a book about tactics. I was there and this is what I did. It had to do with so much of the system's failure during Tet and our being ordered to attack without air artillery support, and why that took place, and why the ammunition, there was no ammunition, et cetera, and why the division commander collapsed when he realized what had happened. So I left that intact. What I later learned was that some of the people involved whom I castigated in the first book actually were resisting many of the orders that were being given by General Tolson, but were overridden. And in the first book, I accused them of weakness, if not a kind of cowardice. And later I found out that they really did put their career on the line trying to prevent what happened to us from happening. And in the afterword, I tried to say that when Desert Storm took place, I felt that we had fully recovered strategically from the failures of the Vietnam War, that we were once again willing to extend our power overseas when it was in our national interest, And with the Powell Doctrine of Overwhelming Force, we had really learned the lessons of Vietnam well, which was an exercise in gradualism. The war in Iraq, Operation Iraqi Freedom, it seemed to me, was the Vietnam War gradualism all over again and unpreparedness. And so I said, everything I thought we had learned in Desert Storm in 1990-91 had been forgotten about in 2003. And I thought that was very unfortunate. When I was serving in the Pentagon at that time, and I was pretty familiar with the very senior leadership there, and there was really no one in the Pentagon in a senior position who was a Vietnam veteran. The only person I could identify was General Peter Pace, but he was a lieutenant in Wei when this book was taking place. And I don't mean to denigrate General Pace's ability, but there was no one else advising that I could find advising Secretary Rumsfeld or President Bush, who could say, look, here are the things that we learned in Vietnam, we did right and we did wrong, and trying to get involved in a civil war or however you describe it, insurrection or whatever, that it's a very difficult and complicated way to go to war because we assume that the enemy is going to play to our strength, which is technology and a lot of firepower and that kind of thing, where in fact the enemies we're facing may not have advanced degrees from distinguished universities, but they're very, very good at what they do, and they play to our weaknesses, not our strength.
We'll continue our conversation with retired Lieutenant Colonel Charles Krohn about the Tet Offensive after these messages.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles. Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. This center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012. The American Veterans Center, 703-302-1012.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell, and my guest this week is retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Charles Krohn, author of The Lost Battalion of Tet, a book which deals with his combat experience in Vietnam. We were discussing some parallels between Vietnam and Iraq, and one was the recognition in both wars that strategy and tactics needed fundamental change.
The failed Westmoreland strategy, it wasn't until after Creighton Abrams came in with a totally different kind of philosophy about how to conduct that kind of warfare, but here you've got a repeat of that. Well, and until the surge in Iraq, the same thing was happening. Not only that, but another analogy, it seems to me, is the micromanagement in both cases from the White House and the Pentagon instead of in the field.
You're really getting my blood up on this one because that's exactly what happened in Iraq. We assumed that our superior firepower, force on force, which was the Westmoreland approach to warfare, the more of them that we kill than they kill of us, the body count syndrome, the fact that who has the most guns and the most ammunition and the most technology will win the war. And in fact, of course, that did get us to Baghdad relatively quickly, successfully. But the war was never a force-on-force war. And we learned that in 03 and 04 when the insurgency started really wreaking havoc with us. And if the sad thing here is that the word insurgency was forbidden in the Pentagon and from the White House, mm-hmm. because they really didn't know how to face this and they didn't understand it. And no one explained it to them, and apparently they didn't seek out anyone who could have.
But there is an irony here, which is that we were, in a sense, victims of our own success because of what happened in the first Iraq War.
Yes, that's exactly right. But because General Powell went in there with overwhelming force, he never had a plan to conquer Iraq, so he never had to worry about the details of occupation. And frankly, driving Saddam and the Iraqis out of Kuwait pretty much accomplished our purpose and sent the signal to Saddam that we would stand in the way of his territorial expansion.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the war itself for a little bit. How in the world can a battalion be ordered to go face an overwhelming force of the magnitude you were up against without artillery, without ammunition, without, you didn't even have your basic kits with you?
Yeah, and of course, that's the failure that I really, you know, I'll go into the details in a moment, but when that happened, we looked upon it at the time as just the fortunes of war and tried to just do the best we can under very difficult circumstances. It's only afterwards when I asked myself, I said, this shouldn't have happened. Why did it happen? That I started probing into the details, and I think I unlocked most of those secrets. What happened was the first episode in the book is the war in Quezon Valley, where we were fighting an NVA regiment, a third of an NVA division, when they attacked our fire base called LZ Ross. And they never succeeded in penetrating our perimeter because we were very well prepared. Then we went on the pursuit, and we weren't prepared for that. And we got cut up pretty badly. But we certainly, during that period, learned to respect the North Vietnamese soldier as very professional, very well equipped. And I'll tell you, at the time, we never really hated the North Vietnamese soldier. I mean, there was professional respect. And we were out to kill as many as we can, and we never lost that focus. Anyway, around Christmas time of 1967, we were ordered to join the rest of the division up at a place called LZ Ross. We had been up north fighting the North Vietnamese. The rest of the division had been in the southern part of Vietnam fighting the Viet Cong. Now, this was General Tolson and his staff's frame of reference. And the deal with the Viet Cong is they were very elusive, very hard to find. And if you found them, you could kill them. But maybe you were able to chase them or maybe not. But the thought of just being able to find the Viet Cong was the challenge. And so you'd go out in these elaborate search and destroy missions one day after another. And you would report kills one or two at a time, day after day. Certainly nothing very exciting, hard work, and really nothing very constructive. Now, the division was ordered north around Christmas of 1967, basically to be prepared to assist the Marines in Quezon, whom you may know, and many of the listeners know, were taking a terrible beating by the North Vietnamese, who basically surrounded Quezon. That was really a ruse, we found out later, to draw American forces away from the cities and up north so that the North Vietnamese later, during the Tet Offensive, could go into the cities with less resistance. In any event, we were up north with the rest of the division at a place called Camp Evans, 15, 20 miles north of Way. And it was an old Marine battalion headquarters, and General Tolson originally was told that he would assemble his division at Way Phu Bai. And all of the provisions and supplies for the new division were prepositioned at Way Phu Bai. However, General Tolson didn't want to move his division to Way Phu Bai. I say in the book, because I speculate in the book, there were too many flags there of other generals.
Coming up after the break, the story of how the 212th Cavalry became entrapped by North Vietnamese near the city of Hue, and how the battalion managed to escape.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles on the Radio America Network.
World War II.
The German news agency said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun.
Korea.
The armed invasion of the Republic of Korea by armed forces from Northern Korea constituted a breach of the peace.
Vietnam.
The curfew is in effect for the Saigon, Cholon, Jiezhen area.
The Gulf War.
The skies over Baghdad have been illuminated. Bright flashes going off all over the sky.
A special thanks to veterans everywhere from the Radio America Network.
Heavy fighting is still raging.
3,639 wounded.
Red light, green light, and out, out. Get
gentlemen,
out.
This is the real thing.
The brutal death march of Bataan.
Germany calling. Germany calling.
Right in the Fuhrer's face.
Pass the ammunition and we'll all
cheer for Harlem Operate.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. Once again, Gene Pell.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell, in conversation this week with retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Charles Crone about his combat experiences in Vietnam during the Tet Offensive. Charles, how did the battalion come to be surrounded by the enemy?
We arrived at Camp Evans and told that our first job was to guard the perimeter of this place. And the question is, gee, we just got through fighting this NVA regiment in Quai San Valley, and, you know, we'd like a little rest. And the answer was, well, we were the only battalion in the division that had ammunition. This is very, very hard to believe. But when we were ordered to displace from Camp LZ Ross to Camp Evans, we were told to leave our ammunition behind because it was a very hasty move to get the division up north at Camp Evans, and that ammunition was heavy and took up a lot of space. And there was a shortage of transportation, trucks and helicopters. So if we left our ammunition behind, they could displace our battalion quicker to Camp Evans.
But what's the point of moving a battalion without ammunition?
Well, the thought was they'd preposition fresh supplies when we got there. And again, this is the mindset of division headquarters was that we're only fighting Viet Cong. So there's really no threat. Well, we had just finished. We were the only battalion in the division, basically, that had been fighting the NVA. So we knew what the NVA could do. And obviously, if we were going to displace by helicopter, you don't know that the weather's going to close in or there'll be mechanical problems. You'll be forced down in the middle of nowhere, and you might be forced down in the middle of an NVA division headquarters. So the thought of moving with no ammunition was just absurd. And we ignored that order and took a double basic load. So that explained why we were asked to provide the perimeter guard at Camp Evans. Now, this transitioned very quickly into the Tet Offensive. And the weather closed in, and the NVA cut off all lines of communication between Wei Fu Bai, where all our supplies were, and Camp Evans, where we were. Mm-hmm. And what this meant was that the division had no JP-4 or fuel for the helicopters, no small arms ammunition, no gas to run the generators, no rockets for the helicopters, no ammunition for the artillery.
Well, you didn't even have any artillery for a while.
Well, the tubes were there,
right?
But no. Remember, the mindset of the division plan was to move everybody north as light as possible so they could get the move done quickly, mm-hmm. and then use the new supplies that were prepositioned at Wei Fu Bai to get back into the game again.
Now, let me ask you right here. Did you have any real advance intelligence that Tet was coming, number one? And number two, did you have any real intel about what the size of the North Vietnamese force was that was going to encircle you?
The answer is no, no, and no. As a matter of fact, General Westmoreland called General Tolson, or communicated in some fashion, and said that the NVA had occupied Wei, the city of Wei, and he was ordered to send a battalion immediately to relieve the Marines surrounded in Wei. Well, first point, you had a very large force behind the walls in Wei, and a battalion never could have done very, very, very much at all. So we had no idea even what the force was in Wei, much less the nationwide uprising. Furthermore, General Tolson, first plan was to airlift our battalion. I mean, there was some fuel available, of course, to airlift our battalion from essentially Camp Evans to the walls of Wei. And the brigade, our brigade commander, intervened with that and said there wouldn't be a battalion left because the we knew or suspected that the NVA, when they occupied the city, had plenty of air defense weapons, and a battalion that tried to airlift to the assault to the Wei, air assault to Wei, would be destroyed in the air. And General Tolson acceded to that and said, okay, we'll airlift into PK-17, and the next day, the same day, they can walk to Wei and relieve the Marines. Well, we were airlifted to PK-17, post-kilometer 17, 17 kilometers from the center of Wei to an old French fort. And then we walked to, we started moving in combat formation to Wei, not down the Route 1, which would have made us very vulnerable to ambush, but we moved inland a bit, which took us to the town of Tan La Chu, which we later learned was the headquarters commanding the attack on Wei and the occupation of Wei. And that force was defended by a very fine NVA regiment. The NVA were smart enough not to put their headquarters for the attack in Wei itself, where they would have been disrupted and so on, but to move it off-site so that they could operate more independently. Very, very clever of them.
So you find yourself now in a situation where you're a battalion that's up against a regiment, at a minimum a regiment, I might add, because I don't know what they had in reserve besides the regular regiment, but there surely was a division in the area, it had to have been, and you get encircled, you can't get anything in, you can't get anything out. You're really on the verge of, your book is called The Lost Battalion. It damn near was a lost battalion, yeah, as a matter of fact. But it raises the question, surely the North Vietnamese intelligence understood your plight. Why didn't they finish you off?
Well, let me go back just a minute. The reason our battalion was selected from all the battalions in the division to conduct this attack to relieve the Marines in Wei is that we were the only battalion in the division to have ammunition.
Right.
So the choices were kind of limited.
But so was your ammunition.
So was the ammunition. Well,
you had the tubes, but yeah, you didn't have the artillery shells to put in them.
We were told to attack Tan La Chu, which we later called TFP for polite conversation, that foul place. We were told to attack Tan La Chu. Colonel Sweet, asked for a delay till the artillery could be brought, displaced to PK-17 just behind us and support us as they've always done, because he knew from the Korean War, his own experiences, that light infantry can't do very well in conventional war without artillery support and a great deal of it. We were ordered to attack nonetheless because General Tolson, as I've quoted from three different people in the book, said not to worry. As soon as they see American uniforms, they will rush back to Laos. Now, the critical point there is he was applying his experience with the Viet Cong to a situation with the North Vietnamese regulars. And we knew that, but he didn't. Mm-hmm. And we saw this whole regiment lined up in front of us about, 200-300 yards away. They were all dug in, plenty of automatic weapons fire. So we recognized that if we attacked into this woods, it would be what we in the military call through interlocking fields of grazing fire. And this is where the whole field is covered with fire from the enemy that never rises above the height of a man. An extremely suicidal mission. I compare it to the charge of the Light Brigade, and the numbers and the results, frankly, were quite comparable. In any event, we all realized what would happen. There was no one thought of disobeying the order, frankly. So what you did was you shook hands with the guy on the right side and the left side and said, see you on the other side, whatever the other side is. And so we assaulted across this field. Casualties were very heavy. They opened up to let us in, a very old maneuver going back to Roman days, frankly. They let us in and then closed in behind us, and they had us locked in. Mm-hmm. We established a perimeter fence, but quickly, they surrounded us maybe only 5-10 yards away, to hug us. So when we got some artillery support, you really had to be very careful how you used it, or it would fall on friendly lines. But that's an old technique, again, that the NVA were very good at, and they'd done that in other places. But the only way you can keep them at bay is massive amounts of small arms fire to basically prevent them from conducting an assault over the top. And once that had ever happened, once they got into our perimeter, we would have been annihilated. I mean, and we all knew that. The issue of ammunition became very critical, more critical than food and water.
Mm-hmm. But I just come back to the point, Charles, that it seems to me that they could have annihilated you if they had wanted to. Now, there must be some reason why they didn't.
Well, remember, we had just been through fighting the NVA in the Quezon Valley. We knew about interlocking fields of grazing fire ourselves. We had very dedicated, experienced, and motivated soldiers who did not panic, who knew their job, who stood their ground, stayed in their foxhole, fired at any movement, and we had plenty of machine guns and M16s, and so long as we had enough ammunition, that we could have probably stopped them from overrunning us. That's a hypothetical, of course. The fact is they did try and probe our perimeter from all directions, and they never got through.
So when the decision was taken to break out, that held its own peril, obviously. Because how do you escape when you're surrounded?
Well, I mean, this is where real professionalism comes into play. Colonel Sweet called the senior people into his foxhole and said, guys, we're in a tough spot right now. It's pretty obvious to everybody. We're not talking now about rank or chain of command. Does anybody have any ideas? Because we need some ideas. And we talked about that, and finally he sent a message back encoded to division saying that we had three options and what did they want us to do. One was to stay and be annihilated. The other one was to withdraw back to PK-17 the way we had come. And the third was trying to escape to the west to the mountains. We didn't like the idea of withdrawing, because it would have been cowardice in the face of the enemy, especially while we had the Marines surrounded in Wei. And I think all of us would have preferred to die in combat rather than be charged with cowardice of retreating while we still had Marines surrounded. And I personally would have died there willingly if that were the option. And I feel that way now, and I felt that way then. In any event, division came back and said that, well, you can do whatever you want, but you make the pick, but remember, you're responsible. So,
yeah, but then they came back after you made the decision and said, don't do it.
Well, that's right, because but by that time, the battalion was, halfway to the mountains to the west, strung out, I suppose, over a quarter of a mile. We escaped in the middle of the night, undetected, and very, very lucky that we escaped undetected, because you were extremely vulnerable, obviously, when you have troops in the open with no place to hide, no place to dig, and no support. I was aware of the risk of that at the time, and I said, Colonel Sweet, what do we do with the dead and wounded if we're caught getting out of this place? And he said he would make that decision only if he had to. He did make the decision again, quite correctly, to leave the dead and equipment behind. When we left Tan La Chu, and I know that there are a lot of people that say, well, you can never leave your dead behind, and so on and so forth. Well, here is a scenario where it would have made no sense to try and carry the dead with us. We were hungry, we were exhausted, no sleep in several days. Most of the soldiers were wounded. I wasn't, thank heavens, but many of the soldiers were wounded, and ended up a total of over 250 wounded during this period. And it takes four soldiers to carry a body. And you're exfiltrate. You're trying to escape encirclement in the middle of the night. To mention the terrain. Can you really use four soldiers to carry each body? And we had 11 bodies that hadn't been evacuated. Or do you need those soldiers to help fight and save the rest of the battalion?
Still, 81 members of the 2nd Battalion, 12th Cavalry, were killed in action between January 2nd and February 28th. Scores of others were wounded. 11 members of the battalion were awarded the Distinguished Service Cross for Valor. Our thanks to retired Lieutenant Colonel Charles Crone for sharing his experiences with us. That's it for this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles, produced by Tim Holbert for the American Veterans Center and Kenny Burns for Radio America, in association with Pelcom Communications. I'm Gene Pell. Thanks for listening.
A special thanks to you veterans for your service to our country.
The latest official report from Washington said that warships had broken off the action and retreated.
From the Radio America Network.